Okay, let's get into it. Today we are unpacking a true giant, Yale University. And this is a deep dive. Our mission here is, well, it's pretty simple. We're going to cut through all the history, the prestige, the
All the
controversies,
layers.
exactly, all the layers. And we want to give you, the learner, a really complete, fast-tracked education on one of the most powerful universities in the world. And we're drawing on just this incredible stack of sources we have right here.
And we really are talking about a global powerhouse. I mean, to understand Yale, you have to get the scale of it right away. It's a private Ivy League research university, and it's the third oldest institution of higher education in the U.S.
Third oldest. So it was chartered before the American
Way
Revolution.
before. And the numbers that define it today are just, they're on another level.
The financial scale alone is mind-boggling. I mean, Yale is an economic engine. The sources point to an endowment of, what is it, $44.1 billion as of 2025?
Yeah, that's an immense amount of financial gravity. And then you have the knowledge infrastructure itself.
Libraries.
Over 15 million volumes.
Yeah.
That makes its library system the second largest academic library in the entire United States.
So it's a serious, serious investment in sustained intellectual capital.
And that capital, well, it translates directly into human influence, into power. The sources, they really highlight this astonishing concentration of power among the alumni.
Yeah, let's run through that list because it's pretty wild. You're looking at five U.S. presidents, 10 founding fathers,
19 U.S. Supreme Court justices.
19, and 72 Nobel laureates connected to the university in some way.
I mean, that is just an unparalleled pipeline of influence.
It really is. And that political pipeline, especially, our sources point out that near unbroken streak of Yale alumni on presidential tickets from 1972 all the way to 2004.
Right.
That feels like the defining political hook of the modern institution. We're definitely going to circle back to how that happens later. But first,
We have to go back to the beginning.
3 centuries back to the very start, we're talking intensely religious Puritan roots, a big rivalry with Harvard, and some very controversial money that gave the school its name.
Right. The origin story of Yale is, at its heart, it's really an exercise in theological preservation. It all starts with an act for liberty to erect a collegiate school, which was passed in the Connecticut colony in 1701.
And the goal seems pretty straightforward, right? Educate ministers, educate lay leaders for this new growing colony.
It was practical, yes, but the driving force behind it, that was intellectual discontent. The founders were 10 congregational ministers.
And here's the kicker, the detail that changes everything.
All 10 of them were alumni of Harvard.
Every single one. They meet up in Branford and they inaugurate the school by, what, donating their own books for a library?
Exactly. A symbolic act. That's why they're known as the founders. And the first rector, a man named Abraham Pearson, he literally starts the collegiate school in his own home in Killingworth.
So why? Why do this? Why not just support their alma mater, Harvard?
Well, that's where the rift comes in. The sources make it really clear there was a serious theological and political split happening at Harvard.
Okay.
A man named Increase Mather, who was Harvard's sixth president, and a lot of other conservative clergy, they looked at Harvard and saw it as becoming too liberal, theologically lax. They felt it was drifting away from the strict Puritan orthodoxy it was founded on.
So Yale wasn't created to expand education. It was a conservative breakaway. It was a
It
reaction.
was a defensive maneuver, absolutely. Mather was championing this new collegiate school, hoping it would be a bastion for the kind of traditional religious thought he felt Harvard was just abandoning. They were trying to build a wall around their original religious mission.
And then the irony.
Oh, the irony is incredible. The very engine they created to preserve this orthodoxy, the library, almost immediately undermines it.
How so?
The sources detail this crucial shipment of books in 1714. It was about 500 books, organized by a man named Jeremiah Dummer. And they represented the best of modern English thought.
So not just Puritan texts.
Not at all. We're talking science, philosophy, theology, Enlightenment thinkers.
Which is just incredible. The collection that was meant to bolster strict Puritanism becomes this vector for radical new ideas.
And the shift was profound. For instance, a young undergraduate named Jonathan Edwards, he discovers the works of John Locke in that collection.
Wow.
And Locke's ideas about empiricism and reason, they completely reshape Edwards' thinking. He ends up developing what he calls his new divinity, which is a major departure from the old guard
And
Calvinist.
it didn't stop there, right? The intellectual fallout got even bigger.
Oh, much bigger. Just
Yeah.
8 years later, in 1722, you have this major event. The school's own rector, Timothy Cutler, and six of his friends, they formed a study group to talk about all these new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
They announced a massive theological conversion. It was known at the time as the Great Apostasy. They publicly declare they've abandoned Calvinism and have joined the Church of England. Anglicanism.
Wait, the head of the school defected? The school founded to fight creeping liberalism.
The head of the school and six key religious leaders, they saw the Anglican structure as more legitimate than the Congregationalist model. They were immediately kicked out, sailed to England, got ordained, and came back as Anglican missionaries.
That's a complete institutional crisis.
It's a total meltdown. And it just shows the irresistible force of Enlightenment thought filtering through those new books.
So for the next few decades, the presidents, people like Thomas Clapp and Ezra Stiles, they're just trying to manage all this.
Exactly. They're navigating the currents of the Great Awakening, which is this religious revival, and the Enlightenment, this intellectual revolution. They're trying to build up the science curriculum to keep pace, but also hold on to some kind of theological grounding, all while dealing with student riots, the French and Indian War, and then the Revolutionary War.
All that turmoil. That must have meant they needed money constantly.
They were always desperate for funds. And that brings us directly to the money that gave the institution its name and the moral conflict that's been attached to it ever since.
Elihu Yale.
Elihu Yale. In 1718, Cotton Mather, who'd been a supporter of the school from the start, he reaches out to this incredibly wealthy Boston-born businessman living in London.
And Yale had made his fortune where?
In Madras, India. He had been the first president of Fort St. George for the East India Company. He'd amassed a huge fortune.
So Mather asks for money, and Yale responds.
He does. He sends over 9 bales of goods, textiles, calicoes, and a portrait of King George I. And when all that stuff was sold in the colonies, it brought in over 560 pounds.
Which, at that time, was an absolute fortune.
A transformative amount of money. And in recognition of that, it was Cotton Mather who suggested, let's rename the school Yale College.
Okay, but here's where the historical reckoning comes in. And it's...
Yeah.
Really complicated.
It's very complicated. Modern analysis of the East India Company's records, which the sources we have really dig into, shows a deep, deep reliance on exploitative colonial trade.
And Elihu Yale himself.
His involvement in the Indian Ocean slave trade while he was in India is, well, it's a matter of debate, but it's explicitly noted by critics.
So the argument is that this foundational money, the money that funded the first scholarships, that kept the lights on, it came directly from the slave trade and colonial exploitation.
That's the core of the criticism, that
yeah.
This money essentially established the financial footing for one of the world's most enduring institutions.
And this isn't just some dusty historical debate. It came to a head much more recently, right?
It did.
Mm-hmm.
In 2020, during the George Floyd protests, the social media tag, #CancelYale, started trending. The demand was to remove Elihu Yale's name from the institution entirely because of these ties.
But there was a weird twist to that, wasn't there?
There was. The sources note that a lot of the online support for the #CancelYale movement was actually being amplified by right-wing pundits.
To what end?
They were using it to satirize what they saw as the excesses of cancel culture. It's a fascinating example of how these really serious historical and moral debates can get co-opted and twisted in modern political fights.
Right. But regardless of the online noise, the central fact is still there. The university's financial foundation rests on some morally complex 18th century global trade.
It does.
Okay, so let's put the finances aside for a second and go back to the curriculum. In the middle of all this flux, President Ezra Stiles had a very specific, intense academic focus.
He absolutely did. Stiles, who was president from 1778 to 1795, was deeply committed to the classical languages. He insisted on rigorous study of Hebrew, right alongside Greek and Latin.
Why Hebrew specifically?
He saw it as essential for studying the Old Testament in its purest original form. For him, it wasn't just a religious subject. It was a core classical language.
And he made it mandatory.
Mandatory for all freshmen, which is a big deal. At Harvard, Hebrew was generally for upperclassmen or students specifically going into divinity. This was Stiles' way of grounding the whole institution in intellectual rigor and the sacred tests, even as the world was changing so fast.
And you can still see that legacy today.
You can. It's literally immortalized on the Yale seal. It features the Hebrew phrase, Urim and Thummim.
Which means?
Roughly, lights and perfections, which links directly to the university's Latin motto, Lux et Veritas, light and truth.
We should also probably mention this one incredible anecdote from that period. It really shows how fragile the whole enterprise was during the Revolutionary War.
Right, style's biggest test. The British occupation of New Haven in 1779.
What happened?
The sources recount that the British forces, after they took the city, they threatened to raise the college buildings. Just burn it all to the ground.
Which would have been the end of Yale.
Completely.
Great take.
It was standard practice. You destroy centers of revolutionary education to break morale. But the school was saved.
How?
A Yale graduate, a man named Edmund Fanning, happened to be serving as the secretary to the British general in command. Fanning personally intervened and argued for the college's preservation.
And it worked.
It worked. The campus was spared. And years later, in 1803, decades after the war was over, the university granted Fanning an honorary degree in gratitude. It's just, it's a powerful reminder of how close Yale came to just being wiped off the map.
Okay, so moving into the 19th century, Yale survives the war, but now it's facing a new kind of threat, right? Irrelevance.
Exactly. The country is industrializing, it's maturing, and the demands on higher education are changing dramatically. Yale is forced to really wrestle with its core identity. What should an American college actually teach?
And this all comes to a head with this document, the 1828 Yale Report.
Yes. And this report is seen as this pivotal but profoundly conservative moment in American higher education. It's basically a staunch, dogmatic defense of the old classical curriculum.
Latin and Greek,
against this rising tide of demand for modern languages, practical science, math, vocational training.
Which feels so counterintuitive. I mean, shouldn't a leader in education be leading the charge for change?
You would think. Yeah. But you have to understand the context. College leaders back then, they were under huge pressure to innovate to get students, but they were terrified of losing their moral purpose.
So the report's argument wasn't about jobs. It was about...
mental discipline. That was the term they used. They argued that studying the classics was the best way to train the mind for any future job. But the deeper reason, the one that wasn't just academics...
it was moral.
It was fundamentally a moral defense. The New Haven scholars, they wanted to create students with strong religious and ethical values. They wanted them to be able to resist all the new isms they feared were corrupting society.
Like what?
Professionalism, materialism, individualism, consumerism. They saw classical education as this wall, this bulwark against the moral decay they associated with the modern industrial world.
So in a way, resisting science and modern languages was resisting modernity itself.
Yes, on the belief that it would lead to moral fragmentation. And this philosophy, it directly fueled one of the most famous academic fights of the late 19th century.
The clash between President Noah Porter and Professor William Graham Sumner.
A classic conflict. Sumner, who taught from 1872 to 1909, was a true pioneer. He was bringing in these brand new disciplines, economics and sociology.
Subjects that relied on observing the real world, not just reading old texts.
Exactly. And his classes were hugely popular. I mean, overflowing with students who were desperate to understand the industrial world they were living in.
But Porter, who was the president and a moral philosopher, he saw this as a threat.
An existential threat to Yale's entire tradition. He didn't just dislike this subject, he actively objected to the main textbook Sumner was using.
Which was?
Herbert Spencer's Social Statics, which promoted what's called agnostic materialism.
Let's unpack that for us.
Basically, it's the idea that matter is the fundamental substance in nature, and everything, consciousness, thought, everything, is just the result of material interactions. It doesn't deny God, but makes God unnecessary to explain the world.
So it's a direct assault on Porter's entire worldview.
A frontal assault. He was afraid it would destroy the students' faith in their character. It's just this perfect microcosm of the new social sciences colliding head-on with established moral philosophy.
And yet, despite all this internal resistance from the president himself, Yale had to expand.
It had no choice. The pressure from the outside world, the need to compete with new institutions like Johns Hopkins. It was too much. The school was becoming too big and complex to just be a college.
So in 1887, it officially becomes Yale University.
Under President Timothy Dwight V, yes. The name Yale College was kept, but only for the undergraduate school. And this renaming happens right as all these professional schools are taking off.
The ones that directly contradicted the 1828 report's whole philosophy.
Right. You have the School of Medicine founded way back in 1810, the law school in 1822. But the 19th century brings the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and crucially, the Sheffield Scientific School in 1847 for practical science and engineering.
And that growth just kept going.
Unabated. You get the School of Management in 1976, and just recently, the Jackson School of Global Affairs in 2022. But the sources note that this expansion caused deep anxiety inside Yale. President Porter feared that embracing this new research university model would corrupt and dilute the undergraduate experience.
And that tension is still there, isn't it? I mean, how do you balance being a cutting-edge research hub with providing a broad liberal arts education for undergrads?
It's the defining tension of the modern university, and Yale has been wrestling with it for over a century. And that whole identity crisis, it wasn't just in faculty meetings. It filtered right down to the students and redefined the Yale ideal.
Okay, let's talk about that archetype. Originally, the sources point to Nathan Hale from the class of 1773.
Right. The aristocratic scholar, athletic, fiercely patriotic, the perfect Renaissance man for the new republic.
But that changes.
It changes dramatically over the 19th century. The student heroes, they increasingly become athletic stars, football players, rowers.
And that shift was driven by whom?
Largely by a powerful alumni base and the student body itself. They wanted to win the big game. That became the symbol of institutional prestige and, frankly, virility.
The sources even mention some fictional examples of this.
They do. There's this turn-of-the-century fictional hero, Frank Merriwell, who is the perfect, athletic, noble Yale man. But then his successor in literature, a character named Dink Stover in a book called Stover at Yale, he actually starts to question this new focus on sports and business.
So the literature reflects a real cultural anxiety about the school's priorities.
Absolutely. And this focus on sports led to the creation of these uniquely American, highly organized athletic programs. Yale, Harvard, and Princeton, the big three, they explicitly reject the British idea of gentlemanly amateurism.
And turn sports into a spectacle.
A huge spectacle, backed by intense alumni fundraising. The Harvard-Yale football rivalry, the game, kicks off in 1875.
And this athletic rivalry actually starts to bleed into the academic world.
It does. Between 1892 and 1909, the language of sports battling opponents, victory, it's directly adopted to talk about intercollegiate debates.
They were trying to manufacture the same hype.
Exactly. Debates were on the front pages of college papers. Debaters got the equivalent of athletic letters. But it never really took off with the same passion as football.
Why not?
Well, as the sources note, scoring is subjective. There's no clear, visceral winner like in a football game.
But this obsession with the sports spectacle, it had a dark side. There was a major crisis around football, right?
A huge one. In 1909 and 1910, the source material talks about this period of alarm because of a series of really serious, sometimes fatal injuries on the field. The early reforms just hadn't worked.
So the public is losing trust.
The public is alarmed, and it's threatening the future of the sport in higher education. This forces the presidents of the big three to step in.
Hadley of Yale, Lowell of Harvard, and Woodrow Wilson of Princeton.
The three of them meet to create moderate reforms specifically designed to reduce injuries.
Mm-hmm.
It shows the power these elite schools had to set national trends.
But even they face pushback.
Huge pushback. Their reforms were diluted by rebellion from the entrenched rules committees and the formation of the Intercollegiate Athletic Association. Even the most powerful university presidents struggle to rein in the cultural force of college sports.
Okay, so moving into the 20th century, Yale starts to physically transform itself. And the campus architecture, it's a statement.
It's more than a statement. It's almost theatrical. It's an intentional effort to fabricate a sense of history.
This is the collegiate Gothic style.
Right. Built mostly between 1917 and 1931, this was almost entirely funded by Edward S. Harkness, who wanted Yale to look like Oxford and Cambridge. And the buildings are incredibly detailed, with little stone sculptures of students, writers, athletes.
But the most fascinating part is the faux aging. The architect went told to make the brand new buildings look centuries old.
Yes. James Gamble Rogers.
Yeah.
It wasn't just aging them. It was a performance. It was about creating instant tradition through trickery.
Give us some of the techniques. They're kind of wild.
Okay, so he would splash the newly cut stone walls with acid to give them a weathered, soot-stained look.
He threw acid on the walls.
He did. He also deliberately had the leaded glass windows broken and then repaired in a rough medieval style to simulate centuries of wear and tear.
That's incredible.
And maybe the weirdest thing, he left decorative niches empty on purpose to make it look like statues had been lost or stolen over the ages. It's creating history through absence.
And it's all an illusion because behind all that ancient-looking stone,
it's modern steel framing, standard 1930s construction.
The sources say one building struggled with that, though.
Harkness Tower. It was built as a freestanding stone structure and it had to be heavily reinforced in 1964 just so they could install the massive Memorial Carillon bells. The Gothic aesthetic met the reality of modern weight and physics.
But Yale isn't just Gothic. There's a lot of architectural diversity.
Right. You have the oldest building, Connecticut Hall, from 1750, which is classic Georgian style. And then you have these iconic modernist additions.
From Eero Saarinen.
Yes. A Yale alumnus himself. He designed the famous whale-shaped Ingalls Rink. And even more striking are the Ezra Stiles and Morse residential colleges.
And he modeled those on an Italian hill town.
San Gimignano, yes.
Yeah.
The sources suggest he chose it because he wanted to evoke that sense of a dense, ancient, protective community. He was translating a medieval European fortress town into modern American residential life. Then you also have Louis Kahn, another giant, who did the Yale Art Gallery and the Center for British Art.
And the thing that holds all these different styles together is the residential college system. It really defines the undergraduate experience.
It absolutely does. The whole system was set up in 1933, again, thanks to a massive donation from Edward Harkness. He'd seen the system at Oxford and Cambridge and loved how it created social intimacy within a huge university.
So it's designed to make a big place feel small. All undergrads are assigned to a college, and most live there.
Right. And they function as these social and cultural hubs. They have small seminars, formal dinners, and master's teas, though they're called head's teas now, which is a whole other story.
A place where students can meet famous people in a really intimate setting.
Exactly. But here's the critical distinction. The colleges are your home and your community, but they are not your academic department.
Right. All the courses and lectures are run by the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and are open to everyone, regardless of your college.
It neatly separates your social life from your academic life.
And layered on top of that communal structure is the world of secret societies.
Mm-hmm. Everyone knows the big names. Skull and Bones, Scroll and Key, Wolf's Head.
And their buildings, the tombs, are designed to be private, but also unmistakable.
They're unmistakable markers of power right in the middle of campus. And the architecture tells you everything. Skull and Bones is this imposing, windowless, Egypto-Doric-style building. It screams ancient power and mystery.
Well, Scroll and Key is totally different.
Totally different. It's more ornamental, a sort of Moorish, Islamic-inspired Beaux-Arts style. They're sending a clear message. We are private, we are powerful, and our traditions are older than most of what you see around you.
But beyond all that serious secret stuff, Yale has some traditions that are just chaotic.
And show a healthy disrespect for authority. One of the more charming ones is the smashing of clay pipes at graduation during the alma mater.
To symbolize breaking from college life.
Right. Though the sources say they use bubble pipes now, probably for safety reasons.
But the ultimate example of student defiance has to be bladder ball.
Oh, bladder ball. It was this campus-wide anarchic game played with a massive inflatable ball, sometimes 6 feet in diameter.
So just pure chaos.
Total anarchy. Minimal rules, lots of injuries, frequent property damage. The administration banned it over and over again.
But the students kept reviving it.
Stubbornly. They saw it as this crucial expression of student spirit and resistance. The last time a big game was attempted was as recently as 2014. That shows you how tenacious these traditions can be.
But of course, despite all the fun and games, Yale's core identity is still about rigorous research. It's classified as an R1 university.
Right. Doctoral university with very high research activity. And the money backs that up. In 2021, R&D spending was over $1 billion. And all that research has led to the formation of these really important, globally recognized schools of thought.
Let's talk about the one in literature.
Okay, so the English and comparative literature departments were central to the new criticism movement. You have huge figures like W.K. Wimsatt and Cleanth Brooks.
And new criticism, for those who don't know.
It's a mid-20th century approach that really stresses close reading of the text itself. The meaning is in the words on the page, not in the author's life or the historical context.
And then later, the Complit department became the American Center for Deconstruction.
Yes, often just called the Yale School. With figures like Jacques Derrida and Paul de Man, it became famous or infamous for questioning fixed meaning in texts, a major, major turning point in literary theory.
And this intellectual leadership goes beyond literature. It even gets into the social sciences that President Porter was so afraid of.
Right. The history department, for example, originated key streams of American historical thought. You've got Southern history with C. Van Woodward and the rigorous study of labor history with David Montgomery.
And all of this research is supported by Yale's massive collections. The library system, again, is the second largest in the country.
The main hub is the Sterling Memorial Library, this Gothic masterpiece that holds about 4 million volumes. But the really priceless stuff is in the Banecki Rare Book and Manuscript Library.
Which is an architectural marvel in its own right. It's famous for those translucent marble panels instead of glass windows.
Exactly. And that marble serves two purposes. One, it protects the manuscripts from direct sunlight. And two, it diffuses the light inside into this warm, ambient, almost cathedral-like glow. It's a stunning space.
And beyond the books, Yale has these world-class museums.
Three key ones. The Yale University Art Gallery, which was the country's first university-affiliated art museum. The Yale Center for British Art, with the largest collection outside the UK. And the Peabody Museum of Natural History.
But even these collections have faced their own historical reckoning. The Peabody used to house artifacts from Machu Picchu.
Right, from Hiram Bingham's famous 1912 expedition. And while taking them was legal at the time, the university, after years of ethical claims from the Peruvian government, finally returned the last of the artifacts to Peru in 2012.
Which shows them actively addressing these colonial-era collection controversies.
It does. It's part of that ongoing process of grappling with its own history.
And that grappling brings us to the major social and political fault lines of the 20th and 21st centuries. Yale has this strange paradox, doesn't it? It seems so conservative and slow to change.
And then it finds itself the absolute epicenter of social progress once that change is finally forced upon it. The inclusion of women is the perfect example.
The road to coeducation was so long. It starts with Lucinda Foote in 1793, who passes the entrance exams but is rejected just because she's a woman.
And women don't officially start studying at Yale until 1892, and even then, only in graduate programs. The pressure for undergraduate coeducation builds and builds. They talked about merging with Vassar in 1966, but Vassar said no.
So Yale finally went co-ed on its own in 1969.
Right. The class of 73 was the first to have women from freshman year on. But bringing women to campus quickly exposed some deep institutional failures.
And that leads to the landmark lawsuit, Alexander v. Yale, in the 1970s.
Which was a legal confrontation that really changed American education. The case involves students and a faculty member suing Yale for failing to stop a pervasive culture of sexual harassment.
And the allegations were serious.
They were shocking. Rape, fondling, and faculty members allegedly offering better grades in exchange for sex.
But the crucial part of this case was the legal strategy.
It was groundbreaking. It was the first time that Title IX, the federal law banning sex-based discrimination, was used to argue that an institution's tolerance of sexual harassment is itself a form of illegal sex discrimination.
And even though the plaintiffs didn't ultimately win their specific cases in court,
the legal reasoning it established changed everything. It was a warning shot to every university in the country. And it forced Yale to immediately create its grievance board and the Women's Center.
And these issues keep coming back. There was another big Title IX complaint in 2011.
Right, alleging a hostile sexual climate, which prompted the university to form another committee to address sexual misconduct. It's an ongoing struggle.
The other major social fault line is about its namesakes, particularly their connection to slavery and white supremacy. Which brings us to John C. Calhoun.
The deeply polarizing figure. A vice president, the famous political theorist, but also a staunch slave owner and an avowed white supremacist. The calls to rename Calhoun College started way back in the 60s, but they got much louder after the Charleston church shooting in 2015.
And President Salovey's initial decision in 2016 was not to rename it.
Right. And his argument was fascinating. He said keeping the name would force students to confront his legacy directly rather than erasing it. His quote was, "We cannot erase American history, but we can confront it, teach it, and learn from it."
It was a very deliberate choice to prioritize confrontation over sanitizing the campus.
It was. Though during that time, they did make one symbolic change. The title Master for the residential college heads was changed to Head of College because of its obvious connotations with slavery.
But then just a year later, they reversed course.
They did. In 2017, they announced Calhoun College would be renamed Hopper College, in honor of the pioneering computer scientist and Navy Rear Admiral Grace Hopper, a Yale PhD.
And that reversal shows just how difficult this process is.
It really does. The sources say the reaction was all over the map. Many students and faculty celebrated, but a lot of alumni and outside observers criticized it as caving to political pressure.
Yeah. Another area where Yale has faced intense scrutiny is mental health.
Yes, specifically its policies around mandatory medical withdrawal.
One 2018 report even ranked Yale as having the worst mental health policies in the Ivy League. The claim was that Yale would pressure suicidal or depressed students to withdraw instead of offering them accommodations.
And the tragedy of Lucheng Wang in 2015 brought this into sharp focus. Her suicide note explicitly mentioned her fear of being forced to withdraw this mandatory full-year leave with a very uncertain path back.
Her friend said she lied to her therapist because she was terrified that admitting how much she was struggling would get her kicked out.
It created this climate where students were incentivized to hide their pain. Therapy became a risk, not a resource. But in response to all the activism and lawsuits, things have finally started to change.
What are some of those changes?
Well, the process was renamed from medical withdrawal to medical leave of absence, and that's not just cosmetic. The new policy lets students keep their Yale insurance and, crucially, visit campus and stay involved in clubs. They're not totally isolated anymore.
And they've also hired more clinicians and gotten rid of the reapplication fee.
Right. It signals a shift toward supporting student health rather than just removing high-risk students from campus.
Finally, let's talk about Yale's relationship with the world around it, both locally in New Haven and globally.
In New Haven, Yale is a behemoth. It's the city's largest taxpayer and its largest employer. It's the economic anchor. But the sources point to this long-standing tension.
The property taxes.
Yale has consistently opposed paying taxes on its academic property, which is exempt. City officials argue that with a $44 billion endowment, the university should contribute more to the city's finances.
But Yale does provide support in other ways.
It does. Most notably, it funds the New Haven Promise Program, which pays full tuition for eligible New Haven public school students who get into Yale. It's a major effort to bridge that town-gown divide.
And internationally, Yale is right in the middle of modern political activism.
Especially in April 2024, when students joined the nationwide protests against the war in Gaza. They specifically demanded that Yale divest its endowment from military weapons companies.
And that led to arrests.
Over 50 people were arrested at protests near Banaki Plaza. And that student activism culminated in a December 2024 referendum where undergraduates overwhelmingly voted to call for divestment.
And then there's this very recent, very serious incident with Russia.
Yes. In July 2025, Russian authorities declared Yale an undesirable organization, effectively banning all of its activities in the country.
And their reasoning was?
The official reason was that Yale's activities were aimed at violating the territorial integrity of Russia and destabilizing the political situation. It's just this stark reminder that an institution of Yale's size and influence is never truly separate from world geopolitics.
So if we come back to the university motto, Lux Veritas, Light and Truth, this deep dive really shows that Yale has been in this constant struggle to define what those words actually mean.
Mm-hmm. It's always balancing this classical elite identity that was forged back in the 18th century with the really urgent demands of a changing, complex world.
And the history is full of that tension.
It is. They founded the school to preserve Puritan orthodoxy. And their first big crisis was their own leadership converting to Anglicanism because of ideas in their own library. They defended the classics against science in 1828, only to become a world-class research university defined by science a few decades later.
And through it all, this institutional commitment to creating a laboratory for future leaders,
yeah,
that seems to have paid off in this incredible amount of political capital.
That concentration of power we mentioned at the start, the presidents, the Supreme Court justices, that unbroken streak on presidential tickets, it demands an explanation.
So what is it? What fosters that?
The sources attribute it not just to legacy and wealth, but to this intense focus on leadership training and what they call the ethos of organized activity on campus. It encourages students to take on these highly competitive managerial roles from day one.
Give me some examples of that.
I mean, look at the institutions they're managing as students. Leading the Yale Political Union, which models parliamentary debate. Managing the Yale Daily News, one of the most prestigious college papers in the country. Running huge volunteer organizations or athletic teams.
So they're learning how to manage budgets, allocate resources.
And most importantly, how to navigate public scrutiny and internal political fights. It creates a very specific type of person, one who is pre-adapted for the national political stage.
It's a fascinating evolution from the old Puritan focus on moral rectitude to this very modern focus on organizational competence. But that brings us to the final paradox that underlies all of this.
And that is that the history of Yale is really a microcosm of America's own intellectual evolution and its social fault lines. You have this recurring tension between the profound positive impact of single acts of massive philanthropy.
Elihu Yale's founding donation, Edward Harkness creating the residential colleges, David Geffen making the drama school tuition-free.
And yet, almost every one of those gifts is tied to these persistent, complex moral questions about how that wealth was created and who the historical figures behind it really were.
Right.
I mean, we've seen the university rename a college because of the slavery legacy of John C. Calhoun, an alumnus. But the university still bears the name Yale, despite all the scrutiny around Elihu Yale's debated involvement in the slave trade that funded its very first endowments.
So that raises a final provocative thought for you, the learner, to really think about on your own.
What does this ongoing, very selective historical reckoning tell us about how elite institutions choose which debts to pay? Which historical wrongs must be erased in the name of modern morality? And which ones, the ones tied to their fundamental identity and origin story, can or even must be sustained?